Wired Country.
Okay, hi, welcome everybody. We have Dani Con da Silva here. She is the founder of Photographers Without Borders, an international traveler, cinematographer, a National Geographic explorer, and a protector of wilderness. Dani, it's awesome to have you on the show. Thanks for coming.
Wow, what an introduction. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're very, very welcome. And I just wanted to jump into one of the stories you started telling me. You are in Tahiti in the South Pacific, and you're just going to some other event, and you get a call from a contact of yours there that tells you to meet him on some random dock somewhere. What happened there?
Yeah, there I was in my like pretty Tahitian dress. And I get a text from my friend who I've been working with. He's an elder, Polynesian elder, who's known for swimming to all five Marquesan Islands. Basically the Polynesian nader. And he said, come with your camera. Meet me at this dock or this pier, I should say. I was expecting him to roll up in a car, but he rolled up in a boat. And I was like, where are we going? And he's like, we're going over to the other island, Morea. And I'm like, okay, you know, I guess we're going to Morea. I'm wearing this dress. I have my camera, no dry bag, no GoPro. My underwater housing was in my bag, which had gotten lost for 3 weeks. So I didn't really have anything for underwater, which was pretty sad for this particular moment. Anyway, so we're heading over in this tiny little boat. So it took quite a long time to reach. And on the way, he's trying to tell me what we're doing. And he's talking to me about this giant dolphin that's stuck in the marina. And I was not sure if I was hearing correctly or if my French was failing me.
Well, they're primarily French speaking there.
Yeah, yeah. Tahiti is known, is part of so-called French Polynesia. And it's known as an overseas territory of France. But it's really like, yeah, it's a colonized place. That's another issue.
Right.
But yeah, so we're heading over, he's telling me about this giant dolphin, and I'm like, okay, yeah, this is so, all right, like I'm ready for anything. We get there and I see like six or seven people huddled around what looks to be a giant dolphin. It turned out to be a Becca Cuvier whale, which is like a large part of the porpoise family, but a large size one that's the deepest sea dwelling porpoise. And so it's got like very small eyes, like lots of scratches everywhere, big teeth, like with an overbite.
Wow. I've never even heard of that kind of whale.
Yeah. Before. They're very, very interesting, rare to see because they live so deep in the ocean. So it had gotten trapped inside the marina, inside the reef. It's hard for them once they're on the other side of the reef to get back because it's very confusing. It's a lot brighter towards where the reef line is. It's shallower. And they have to find the right entryways. And so it had been trapped in this marina apparently for 2 days. The day before they had tried to get it out with a boat, like towing it, and it wouldn't come. Like it was refusing to come. So the person I was with, his name is Ismail, and he's, I don't know, like the best way to describe him is the Ace Ventura of Polynesia, because anytime there's something serious happening or something that's like a mystery that has to do with the ocean, he's called. So once we got there, he jumped in the water and just started talking to this whale. And you know what these six or seven marine biologists and Ocean Association people couldn't do in 2 days, like he started coaxing her out to the reef. Once we got a little bit closer, he told me to jump in the water. So I was just like, okay, I guess I'm not photographing this. I'm going to be a participant today, which sometimes can honestly be a gift when you're a photographer, because so much of the time you're caught up behind the lens and, you know, you don't get to be in the moment. So this was one of those moments where I was like, not able to make photographs, but I got to swim alongside this whale as they coaxed her out to the reef. Once we got there, Ismail asked us to introduce ourselves to her. He told us her name was Teta. Speaking to her in Tahitian, and she seemed to understand what he was saying. And each of us was given an opportunity to introduce ourselves, hold her head in our hands, put our foreheads to her forehead, and then send her off in this really beautiful way. And so they actually successfully were able to have her cross the reef. And to our knowledge, she made it safely and you know, didn't pass away. But a lot of times when that happens, they can actually drown.
Right, because if they're stuck, they need to breathe air. They're a mammal.
Exactly.
So if the tide comes in and they're completely underwater, their blowhole's underwater, they can't hold their breath forever. They can't breathe underwater, right?
Yeah, especially when they're stressed and, you know, they've been trying to like escape for 2 days or however many days, and it can get to a point where they just give up.
Wow.
But yeah, it was like one of the most beautiful moments of my life.
Oh, that sounds so cool. So, and it's just so neat that it ended in this a happy ending. But you rushing to the dock to meet somebody, not knowing where the heck you're going, having a bit of a language barrier. Do you speak French?
Yeah, I do. Oh, it's cool. Getting better.
Okay, well, that always helps. But you speak French, but it sounds like there's a bit, you know, it's French, very different accents all over the world and whatnot, and different types of French. And next thing you know, you're in the water with this rare species of porpoise or from that family, and you're coaxing it. What do you mean by coaxing it out? Because it sounds like, this guy who sounds super legit, he's like a Polynesian elder that can almost connect or almost speak with animals to an extent. And so when you mean coax, was he pulling her out or was he trying to actually communicate with her vocally?
Both. Mm-hmm. So there were, like I said, a number of people actually like holding her and like keeping her up above the water. And then he was kind of at the front and at the side sometimes. Sometimes he was swimming alongside and he would, you know, call her by her name, Data, like, come this way, come this way. I don't know exactly what he was saying because I was in the boat up until a certain point. And when I got in the water, he kind of switched out and then he came back into the water when we got to the reef. So I don't know exactly what was being said, but... Mm-hmm. I've been fascinated by animal communication for some time now.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially as somebody with I have a biology background, a psychology background. And in a lot of these spaces, we kind of, you know, we've been telling ourselves as humans in the so-called the global north, especially, that animals don't think and feel, that they don't have consciousness.
Well, that was the leading scientific belief for a very long time.
For so long.
You know, anybody that's owned a dog probably would disagree with that.
That's what I'm saying. I'm like, does anyone have a cat or a dog in here? Like, yeah, but so I've always been fascinated. I've watched so many documentaries. I've read books. I try to become a better communicator with my dogs. But yeah, it's fascinating. And I think it's one of those things as a scientist that like, it really intrigues me and makes me more curious. So I don't know exactly what's going on, but he communicates with these beings.
Are you going to, it's interesting that first of all, I remember listening to one of your interviews or one of your TED talks, and you mentioned how orangutans are genetically like 97% humans. Where there's just very small amount, you know, so just from a scientific standpoint, how could orangutan not feel love or human emotions yet a human does with just, you know what I mean? It just seems like a no brainer when we're so close.
Yeah. The most parsimonious explanation would not be that.
Yeah. No, absolutely. You know what I mean? Absolutely.
Especially like with orangutans, they're like, they're known as being the best mothers on the planet. Like, you know, and that's why to have an orangutan or to, you know, have trafficked one or have one as a pet or in a zoo, like most of the time you have to kill the mother to get them because that's how good of mothers they are. That's how much they love and care for their babies.
So people with pet orangutans that want a baby orangutan that are adorable
are
might not know that their mother. Yeah. Well, first of all, it's illegal and places like, you know, it happens places like Sumatra and whatnot, right? That the mother has been killed to then steal the baby.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's so sad. Mm-hmm. Are you filming, are you doing a documentary? Like you want to learn more about, you know, the guy in Tahiti and you want to go back there and you want to, so you don't know all the answers exactly how he's talking. Cause when he says this, this dolphin's name is, it's like, did the dolphin tell him that? Right. Or did he just give it a name himself?
These are the kinds of things that are given to me almost as gifts, like secrets of the ocean, of the universe. As Ismail puts it, there are different gates, you know, and there's different portals and we can open these portals. And so I'm still in that process of learning, building trust and, you know, the intention is to make a bigger documentary about this. And yeah, but I think I'm always in a process of learning, even with projects or stories that I've been working on for decades. Mm-hmm. I still am constantly learning.
You don't know all the answers.
No, you don't know what you don't know.
You're hesitant to guess until you learn a little bit more. I suppose. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's cool. And we know, one of the things about whales is we know they have a language, right? Yeah. Dolphins, whales, and they can talk with the high pitched sounds and people can listen to them. So it seems like very, very possible to be able to learn how to speak whale. You know what I mean? Like you hear of somebody who's a horse whisperer or somebody that's incredible at training dogs, which, you know, I'm half decent. I can't say I'm the best always when my dog doesn't come back. But, you know, I know that there is a way and a language you can do it. But when you're dealing with an animal that actually has a real language, I mean, there's something, a real possibility. And I feel like if there's anywhere it's going to happen, it's somewhere that's such an amazing, like, ocean-based area that's so close to the kind of wilderness of the ocean, so to speak. So that sounds really, really cool. I've never been, but the South Pacific's always been somewhere that just seems like this, I don't know, amazing place.
Mm, it really is. Yeah. It really is. And there's a lot that happens out there, unfortunately, too, that doesn't get talked about, like not just dumping, but also the deep sea mining, the illegal fishing, the radioactive, I think the French have tested like nuclear bombs several times in some of the outer islands, as they say. But yeah, it's really had a massively negative impact on a lot of the locals. And, you know, like the debris from radioactivity, especially in the ocean, is going to go to other places. It's an amazingly magical place. And all of this knowledge also, you know, when we start to really understand it, like imagine we could understand, and like communicate with the ocean beings in this way. And that's what he's trying to do, not only with this documentary, but with his work, is to pass it on to the next generation and teach the youth how to connect with the ocean, how to communicate with these beings, because, you know, what would that open up?
I mean, maybe it's crazy, and I don't know if it's possible, but, you know, you're talking about like grassroots programs to help certain people in less fortunate areas, developing areas of the world. What a great way to help, you know, whales by talking, asking them what they want to do. And it sounds like potentially there's possibility to do just like that in not such a metaphoric way, you know?
I agree.
Yeah.
I think we should be making more inroads to listening, to communicating. And in so many Indigenous communities that I've worked with, and I'm sure you've come across this too in your work, is that in the creation stories, there's so much about animals teaching us, or non-human beings, I should say, teaching us, because we're animals too. About us learning from them, about them pitying us, you know, and giving themselves to us so that we can eat, so that we can have our homes, so that we can stay warm, so that we can be sheltered, you know. And I think that there's something really, like, there's a reverence I have for the world, I just really want to understand. So through the documentary, through whatever it is I'm doing, that's what I'm trying to do, is like uncover that, so that we can benefit our current generations and future generations.
So you don't want to give any spoilers, but you don't really, that's kind of one of the interesting things about filmmaking though, too, isn't it? Is that about documentary filmmaking, is it's not like, I don't want to give any spoilers, because when you're actually out there actually following a story as it happens in front of you and following it with the cameras, you don't really know what the end's going to be. You don't know if it's going to be a happy ending. For me, I don't know, because I'm the guy in front of the camera. I don't know if it's going to be an embarrassing ending. You know what I mean? And if it is, I'm like, I got to show that. You know
exactly,
what I mean? Yeah. You got to be real and be like, well, I'm an idiot. I guess that's going on YouTube, right?
Yeah. No, I've never done like a very highly scripted documentary ever, you know? The documentary with him, we kind of know where we're going to go. He already has all these relationships with specific beings. Mm-hmm. He knows when to go, where to go, all of that kind of stuff. But I feel like I'm just getting kind of like little gems of knowledge at a time. And I feel like the doors, you know, they're opening more and more, and I'm understanding more and more.
Yeah. I think one of the things too is that unfortunately people like that, you know, some of the indigenous people in, you know, the far north, Inuit people that have that amazing sort of skill. What one that I've seen is just an amazing skill of navigation, right? No compass, no GPS, white out, boom, I know exactly where I'm going. What? You know, and those things are kind of a magic, really, aren't they? And what you're talking about is really a magic that's going to be a really a lost skill. And as we come into the more, well, it seems like it's going to be, because I don't see the next generation, you know, we're, for example, using GPS as modern technology. The way of life is changing at a lot of places. It's less land-based and usually not for better. I just think that it's so important to kind of not lose that knowledge, you know, and a lot of that is happens to be indigenous people, especially elders that know this kind of stuff. I have a friend, Alex Mathias, who, you know, lives on ancestral land in the Temagami region. And one of the things he says is how many elders took so much to their grave. Because they don't want to be, they don't expect, they don't want to go tell people, hey, you got to know this, you got to know that, or you got to know this. They kind of have to be asked to share. And I think a lot more people are maybe nervous to ask. But I think when people do ask, that they'll get a lot more answers. I don't know if you found a similar parallel to that at all.
Yeah. There's so much there. I think that I see things from a different vantage. I hear you on a lot of what you're saying. I like to frame things. I think language is power. So I like to, I never say like something's going to get lost. Because I actually, from my vantage, and it's because I'm engrossed in this every day at Photographers Without Borders, which I know we're going to talk about soon. We work also with many indigenous communities. And I think, yeah, just from what I see, the resurgence of knowledge globally, the resurgence of interest of wanting, of youth wanting to know their own languages. And I think like fostering that interest is actually what's really important of indigenous youth to their own teachings. I think everyone is indigenous to somewhere. I mean, I know that we are all indigenous to somewhere. I think it's really important for all of us to reconnect with our own teachings. I think being fascinated by, you know, other teachings or other communities is a really important window into this craving that we have to understand ourselves.
And it's, there is a resurgence. And also when it comes to just like survival skills or outdoor traditional skills, I mean, it's kind of getting cool nowadays with shows like Alone and Survivor Man and Bear Grylls. And that might be something for the younger gen and all that stuff. I think one of the important things that kind of gives people a connection to nature to get out there, which I think is kind of a core base between when it comes to wanting to protect wildlife and wild spaces and stuff like that.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Hello there, video game folks. I got a game for you that includes some great adventuring. It is Beast Lord, The New Lands, a free strategy game with new animals, and it's pretty cool. You download it right onto your mobile phone from Google Play and the App Store. It's the ultimate mobile gaming experience, and it leaves you right on the edge of your seat. In Beast Lord, you'll step into the shoes of a mighty hero tasked with saving the realm from darkness. But you're not alone. You'll forge alliances with powerful beasts, each with unique abilities and strength to aid you in battle against hordes of enemies and colossal bosses. From fierce dragons to mystical unicorns and even dinosaurs, the possibilities are pretty much endless. There's more. By logging in today and second day, you'll receive the Supreme Combat Hero. Lion is a melee hero with huge combat attributes and a unique command slash leadership talent. So my friends, keep focusing on training the lion in the early stages. It will increase the expedition quantity of the Beast Squad. You'll get bonus points and you'll level up faster. Helping us join the important battle, the competition for Forest King, more swiftly. Use redeem code BL777 for exclusive benefits specially prepared for early development. So why wait? Join millions of players worldwide and become the ultimate Beast Lord today. So download now and unleash your inner hero.
And now back to the show.
But I have to ask you, what is it about the word lost that is it just because you're not seeing that as a pattern, or is it that you don't like, because it's never going to be lost, it's always there, it would have to be rediscovered? Is that why you don't like the word lost?
That might be part of it, but it's also because I don't see that actually happening. I see this almost
I love the positivity.
Well, it's not just positivity. It's also, I see it as a colonial narrative, actually, that these things are going to be lost. These languages are going to be lost. That, you know, these people are disappearing. These languages are disappearing. I think that Indigenous people have always been here. Like, I always hear, oh, the Mayans are extinct or the Inca are extinct. It's like, no, I have Mayan friends. So, like, there's a lot of these narratives that kind of go around.
Similar native people were in the past. Oh, they did this. They did this. Not they're
preserving
doing
them
this,
in
or
amber.
They're still here.
And then the white saviorism of, like, let's, like, there's a certain photographer, I won't mention their name, but they have a book called Before They Pass Away, which is an anthology of like Indigenous portraiture and stories, but it's like the really problematic title, right? And the reaction to it has from Indigenous country has been, you know, rightfully like, you know, we are always going to be here. We always have been here. And we always will be here. We'll continue having kids. We'll continue passing on our stories.
When I was talking to Jay Morrison, who paddled across Canada, this is actually one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard. He was talking, it was National Aboriginal Day, and he was in Fort Simpson, Northwest Territories. And he was talking to the chief, and Jay Morrison, you know, white kind of Canadian dude. And he said, you know, what happens when there's no more Dene people? And the chief told him, well, there's always going to be Dene people because the land will teach them to be Dene people. I thought that was very interesting.
You know? I mean, it's so funny. I was like,
really usurps race, though, essentially.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah. The memories are in the land. Mm. And actually, what's interesting, what I'm seeing with the Moisca people, if you ever heard of the legend of El Dorado, like the Golden City,
a little bit familiar.
They were the people that the, you know, the conquistadors that came in the 1400s, you know, nearly exterminated, and they didn't kill all of them. People simply had to hide who they were, though, to survive, right? They had to convert to Christianity or Catholicism to survive. And then there was the whole policy of, like, you know, mestizo, like, you know, to literally, like, become part of the people through, like, rape and torture and pillaging and all of these things. But I know Moisca people, you know, like, they're after 500 years, they're starting to really, like, come out and, like, to reclaim. And they talk a lot about the land holding their memories and their songs. And it's true in so many ways, because the land is what holds, like, you know, their cotton, for example, which is a huge part of their traditions and ceremonies. There's their communication with the birds, with all of the beings of the land. They see everything as people, rocks, stones, water. Water is their government, you know. So there's so many of these teachings that the land has preserved, and also that the other Indigenous communities have kept for them. So, I mean, there's so much truth to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I'm hearing now from you, too, is that you know, you founded Photographers Without Borders. And it sounds like keeping these things in mind, or just being aware of them, is important when you do your work, which is obviously coming from a very good place, but you want to make sure it comes from essentially their narrative as opposed to yours, the people you're photographing. So I'd like to hear, and I'm also hearing, how much more enriching your life has been because of travel. We've talked about the South Pacific. I mentioned Sumatra, where we've been, and we're talking about different places. Could you share a little bit about Photographers with Borders, Without Borders? Sorry, might as well probably get that right. And maybe what they do and where it has led you. And it sounds like it's really been an enriching and educating experience for you.
It's a giant question. I love it. So Photographers Without Borders, we're a not-for-profit. I would look at it now as my experiment in how a decolonized not-for-profit can look like. And there's so much to break down and dismantle, even within that sentence. But yeah, it's really that for me. And also, I think early on in my life, I just became really aware of how precious this little blue dot is. And
I think we can all agree with that.
Yeah. And how precious our connections are and how important the intactness of it is. Like, I did a lot of studies into, you know, climate change and all of these types of things. And climate change is really important to understand and all of that, but it's so intangible. It's like, what does it all mean, right? How do we address something that's like so big that it permeates everything that we do? But when you think about like protection and protecting the intactness of what we have in terms of systems, in terms of languages, in terms of the ways we relate to the land, I think that's what became most important to me. And, you know, as a conservation biologist, I found it really just dry, like constantly coming up with reports and research. And there was a point where I was doing research for like a global institution. And, you know, it was just really, I felt like the important messages weren't getting communicated. And also scientists are really bad communicators. And I actually ended up teaching a course called Environmental Visual Communication. And that was the whole point of the whole organization or the degree existing is to address the fact that scientists suck at communicating. And so I remember I was like trying to give lectures about what was happening in India with another project I was working on. That was a project that was really near and dear to my heart, where I was reconnecting with my own ancestral roots. But what I saw was like how powerful the photographs were that I brought back. Like, people didn't care what I was saying, didn't even hear the words. Like, I was just droning off until I showed some pictures, you know, and it was like, light bulb. That was in 2009, before social media. Like, now I think everyone gets like that, you know, visuals are super important. They can, they can do
tell
a lot.
Tell a thousand words.
Tell a thousand words, but they can also, they become your reality, right? Like, what you see is what you believe in this world that we live in now. And so they're really important. Different types of stories, film, all of these types of things. So yeah, Photographers Without Borders was really born to address the dearth of stories in terms of like, how can we actually protect the land? How can we like move away from these numbing, apathy driving stories that were just, you know, giving us
not
so much
engaging
information
or inspiring anybody? Yeah, just, it sounds like,
I had so much information as a youth, like that I was like, oh my God, the world's going to collapse. Like, I was so hyper aware of everything that was going on that there didn't seem to be any light. And I think that's a huge problem. There's like a huge swath of people ready to be activated and like, kind of, they have the information, they have the knowledge, but like people who actually respond to facts are least likely, are people that like already care about these things that don't need to be swayed, but they're just kind of like waiting to be activated or becoming pessimistic or like their idealism is being lost to cynicism. And, you know, so for me, it was a way to activate people really, through imagery.
Just to, rather than just rattling off some facts, people need something that they can see, a visual thing that almost is almost tangible, I guess, to an extent, you know, a photograph, right? And so you wanted to tell stories about people mostly in developing nations, about the struggles of people, but also the struggles of animals a little bit as well. So what exactly does Photographers Without Borders do to sort of to help or to try to assist people that are helping?
Yeah, so, and by the way, we work all over the world. There are developing nations within nations, right? Like, we have a grantee from last year who's working on a story in Dallas, Texas, around like climate racism, you know, around how factories are always placed next to communities of color, or communities of color are pushed out of other, you know, areas of the city and placed next to these really polluted,
sort of from the not in my backyard, and whoever has the most political push and money gets it out of their backyard until it winds up in the people that don't have much of a voice's backyard.
Exactly. So I mean, we will cover and support storytellers who are doing any and all kinds of stories that not only are working towards protecting the environment and the planet, mm-hmm. But we also want to support storytellers who have a deep relationship with the communities they work with or are from the mm-hmm. communities that they're working with. And we provide grants every year. So we have this thing called the Revolutionary Storyteller Grant. Mm-hmm. So we're able to provide at least 5 of them a year right now. I'm hoping that we can give more in the future. And that's open to anyone from all over the world. We just, like I said, had our most recent round, and we had 2 Palestinian photographers from Gaza, who were the top 2, like mm-hmm. of all the finalists, which I was like so floored. One of them wants to do a story about the green spaces in Gaza that are left. And the other one's doing a story on the animals of Gaza and their relationship mm-hmm. to people and how people have been, just caring for their pets and caring for each other through this genocide. And it's a really emotional mm-hmm. thing that's happening right now. Just seeing those applications come through really like melted my heart, and to see what they want to work on. We support stories from all over the world. We also are really interested in supporting any storyteller on the planet with creating a more ethical approach to what they do and also to decolonize their work. Mm-hmm. So we have educational programs that we mm-hmm. also offer.
Very cool. Yeah. So you're doing education, you're helping support other groups of people that are sort of grassroots, it sounds like, in certain areas. So what are some of the areas that I guess your work with Photographers Without Borders has taken you? What places? And I imagine that you have done some other travels for filmmaking or just maybe for fun. Like, what was it that drew you to want to travel, to want to see other places and connect with different cultures initially, I suppose would be interesting to hear about.
Yeah, definitely. It's me being who I am. Like, it's mm-hmm. being a woman who's in a body that's like, looks like this, that gets certain reactions from people, questions, where are you from? Where are you from? Where are you from? Mm-hmm. And then growing up on land that, you know, when I was in grade 2 or something, I became aware that our school was built on a native burial ground, which was horrific.
Oh man.
So I became aware at an early age of like, that there were things happening in the world that weren't quite savory, and I didn't quite understand it. So mm-hmm. I'm a curious person. Mm-hmm. Like, I wanted to know, like, where am I from? Who are my people? Like, mm-hmm. I clearly am not from here. Like, you mm-hmm. know, people are asking me where I'm from.
Right.
So by the time I was able to travel, yeah. I just wanted to go and see, like, yeah. you know, and one of the places I went to early on was India. Which uh-huh. is, I'm half Indian and half Portuguese. And even within the Indian side, it's like Mongolian, Afghani, like there's a Persian, okay. there's a whole bunch of stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Apparently we're related to Genghis Khan.
Oh, well, I don't know if I go around bragging about my ancestors were probably Vikings. So I don't know if that's much
my
better.
My grandfather was always very proud of that and yeah, always wanted to cool. share that. So
That's awesome.
But yeah, like I think that migratory kind of that was always in our blood. And
so you think you have that gene, because there's actually a Nat Geo article I read, and it talked about the explorer's gene that they say 1 in 10 people have. And so those people are more likely to take risks in general in life. They're more likely to like the outdoors, camping, not being in perfectly comfortable situations. And it sounds to me very clearly that your idea of travel, whether it is for a purpose, for a cause, is photography driven, story driven. You want to try to make a difference and help people. But it also just sounds like it's definitely not your average, let's go to an all-inclusive resort and like lay on the beach and talk to other tourists kind of thing.
Most definitely not.
Yeah.
For me, it's like my whole life. I'm a Sagittarius too. I don't know what you think about astrology.
Well, you did say you're part Indian. So, you know, that's
thank you.
It's big
yeah.
there. Yeah.
Yes,
the oldest religion, if you will, ever. There's 12,000 year old megalithic ruins that have literally etched into them the cancer symbol of the stars. You know, they might only be 8,000, between 8 and 12,000 years old, that look the exact same as somebody that would have a tattoo today.
Yeah, and it doesn't
which
surprise
just blows
me
my
at
mind.
All.
Yeah,
yeah, because the ancients, just as our current astronomers, my dad's an astronomer, like studied the stars. Because what else would you do if you had this beautiful display every night? Like, you'd want to understand your relationship to it. Who am I? Where am I? Like, all of these things that I guess phones have distracted people from, and light pollution and whatnot. But yeah, I really wanted to know, like, who am I? Where am I? Like, what? Why am I? And those questions came early on for me. I guess, yeah, just with my positionality and just different experiences I've had in life. Some like dark experiences too, like, which really woke me up, you know, like in terms of why I'm so outspoken. Why I can't have a boss, why I need to like be in charge of my own life. Like,
I can relate to that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe coming, you see, you have definitely a good, you know, traditional, what's it called? Like degree education behind you, but yet you've pivoted and you're kind of like, you're like me in that the fact that you've kind of led your own course, there was no like course I could take, but you also have that base in academia too. Do you find those two things to be similar, where you, are passionate and where you have that, you know, will to explore? Do you find that it's what does the cart come before the horse, or vice versa? Is it your passion to explore and do things that then drive you to essentially make a career out of it? Learn, like, you didn't go to school for photography and filmmaking. No. That's like a whole other thing that some people do a whole other course for. Was it which one came before the other, and was the passion to explore, to connect, to help, to change a narrative, tell stories? Was your push in storytelling through, you know, behind the camera, through that medium? Did that come first, or did the other come first, and are they related?
Oh, I love these questions.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's so good. Great. I just thought of that. What can I say?
No, you're brilliant. I think alignment and purpose in life has always been super important for me. So I see life as the greatest teacher, the greatest school, if you're living it towards alignment. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, like, as you live your life, you start to have certain experiences that you need to decide, okay, how am I going to act from here? Like, knowing this information, how is my behavior going to change? How is my mindset going to change? You know, and we change incrementally or sometimes drastically to suit that. And so in that pursuit, like, that's where the greatest teachings have come from. And I find, honestly, from all the education and the, you know, what I see as colonizer school in many, many cases, I feel like I've had to unlearn so much of it and relearn. And like, that in itself has been an adventure. If you want to talk about a life of adventure, it's like, how aligned can I be within this capitalist colonial system? And like, when it comes to a career, I didn't ever go to school for being who I am or doing what I'm doing. It was more like listening to the school of life, listening to my own intuitive compass, honing that too. Like, this system here, that's something that's also magic, you know, just like the inner knowings of like which path to follow. Maybe that's part of the explorer gene.
I don't know. That's interesting.
But it's like this trusting yourself that, like, okay, I got these choices and that's the one I'm going to make. And that's, you know, like, things are going to unfold in a certain way because of that. But for me, it's like, I don't see my job as a job. I see it as like what I need to do to survive, like, or to thrive. You know, like, I need to put my energy somewhere that's going to benefit more than just myself in this little lifetime, you know? And I think about that too a lot as somebody who doesn't have kids. You know, I think about having kids a lot. And, you know, I also think, like, I want to be able to live a life that I would be proud to share with them and to like show them, but also like to the many like around me that I see as like almost, I don't know, students, children, whatever, like just anyone that I can impact, because I truly believe that certain things are possible if we if we want to believe that they're possible, right? And that goes back to that whole, like, why I don't want to use certain language, because I feel like it limits or creates possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or blocks it.
Yeah. I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah, no, I think you did. I think that what you, I think what you told me was sort of like, it was sort of your passion for telling stories that made the learning of filmmaking and photography sort of come to life. But yeah. you thought that it was this a medium that you could, that was powerful, that had power, that you could get a message across, that attracted you to it. And are you attracted to it as well from a, I don't know if that was true. I don't want to, but are you attracted from just an artistic perspective as well, or just from a kind of journalistic perspective?
Oh, I am. It's all of the above. Like, mm-hmm. I'm one of those people who like takes everything and mashes it together. Yeah, I guess you call it a Renaissance person. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So you had to be your own. You had to kind of go your own route, essentially.
I had to go my own route for many reasons. Kind of like I said, like there's some dark stuff that happened in my life that, or that I was, you know, that I witnessed that was like very much pushed me on my path, like from an early age. But also, yeah, I think that the camera is like, it's like a window into someone's soul. It's like a way to find myself in interesting places with interesting people, like, and to keep learning, that process of learning. It's like the things I photograph aren't for clients. Like, yes, I can find people to fund my passions or like the stories that I'm working on, but that's what comes second. First comes the relationships and like the story itself, you know? And so like, that's kind of what photography does for me. It opens worlds, whether they're underwater, whether it's a jungle world, whether it's like, you know, peering into the life of an insect, you know, like, and just like really like studying that world. When you see as a photographer, yeah, you of course artistic, there's an artistic nature to it because you're seeing with light, like my eye, like the way I see now compared to before is just, it's wildly different. I see pictures everywhere. I see beauty everywhere, you know, like, and yeah, it's just, it's a beautiful way to connect. To connect with the world around you.
I would agree. And I think, too, something that I can relate to that I should touch on is when you're talking about doing it for you in a way, that's where the authenticity comes from. If people go out there and they think, I'm going to write a pop song, or I'm going to do this because I think I'm going to do something. You see this all the time in movies. I'm going to do something in the way that I think people are going to like. And it's this big blockbuster with millions of dollars spent. And you're like, what the hell is this? It's because they weren't doing it for themselves in almost like a personal journal kind of way. And it's unfortunately, what's going to catch on is that kind of realness of kind of looking in, rather than trying to be what you think other people are going to like. Does that make any sense to you?
1,000%. Yeah. I wish I could attribute this quote to the right person, but something I read the other day where it's like, you know, a lot of people, they think too much about like their audience. Like, you shouldn't be thinking about your audience when it comes to your art. Like, you make art for yourself, and then whoever also likes it also likes it. You know,
right.
Like, that's really what the process should be.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it's riskier though. You have to be braver, I suppose.
Oh, that's right? Interesting. Bravery, courage, yes. You know, like what's this one little life for if we're not going to be brave and courageous?
Right. I mean, I'm telling you, if you write something that's maybe a little flowery that made you even have some emotions while you're writing and someone reads and they're like, boring, you're just like, like, you know, like it doesn't make you feel very good. So you have to be, you kind of have to have a thick skin, but you also have to be brave to sort of put yourself out there a little bit.
I think so.
For sure.
I think what makes people struggle sometimes is they get so distracted by like that one opinion, like, and it might be from the person closest to you. It could be from a sibling or a parent or, you know, somebody who downplays your work. And I think something that I've noticed between myself and every artist I know, it's like, it's not always going to be those people around you who are your biggest supporters. And I think we need to put less emphasis or expectation even on like what, you know, maybe the people around us think, because somewhere in the world your work's going to connect with someone, and then if you focus on those people that you're connecting with, then you can grow something. If I listened to the people around me, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. I'd be working in a 9-to-5 cubicle, like, you know, repeating the patterns of, you know,
doing a safe job,
doing whatever they think brings comfort and security and safety. And it's like, my goodness, like, I love you so much, you know, and I think I'm speaking mostly to like my mom here. It's like, I love you so much. I appreciate your way of being, but like, because of you, I'm now able to do all of these other things, you know, like, so I appreciate that, like, that mentality, because it was a survival tactic that gets a lot of people to a certain place. But then it's like, that's now allowing me to do more and go further.
What you're scared about the kind of negative side of capitalism is just becoming that person that works for somebody else that doesn't really get to contribute in the with the powers that they really have.
But I see why people are like that. Like, we live in a seriously messed up world. Like, capitalism is, you know, it's not what they kind of trained us to believe it would be, you know, like, it's not fair. It's not like the benefits don't trickle down to everybody, you know? So I totally get why people have this trauma around money and, you know, see these limitations. But I think it's really important to remember that so much of like what we see as possible is in our minds. Mm-hmm. And like, that can change in like an instant if we have an insight, right?
Love it. Yeah. Love it. Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think that's a great sentiment, and easier for some to say than others, but possible. I mean, some of the people that have dealt with the most challenging things are the people that have also completed and achieved the most amazing things as well. Yeah. At the same time, I feel like we all have that in ourselves, maybe in different different facets, right? You know, I probably misquoted, but there's this thing that Einstein says, everyone's a genius, but if you judge a fish on how it climbs a tree, you're going to think it's stupid or something
like that. Totally. Yeah. I ascribe to that. That's a big one.
Yeah. I think with parents too, it's like, they are very much, or you know, want what's best for their kid, and they come from the good place, but what that is what they know and what they're comfortable with. Mm-hmm. So you or I would probably be more likely to say, you know, get out there and freaking go photograph, you know, orangutans in Sumatra to their kid. Whereas a lot of, you know what I mean?
From yeah, no, it's generation. Like, that's like a hugely privileged place right. to speak from. It's right. like, oh my gosh, the things I'm doing, my parents could never have imagined, right. I don't think, for me. Like, I think they're just like, oh my gosh, like, what do you even do? Like, you know, like, how do you make an income? Like,
do you find it hard to explain what you do?
Totally.
To people? Yeah, I do. Totally. What do you do?
How did you come up with my intro?
I just started talking. I remember one time the CRA called me and they're like, Jim, like, we're going over your tax, your GST. What do you do?
Oh, yeah.
And
I'm
I'm like, I'm an adventurer. And they're just like, oh yeah, I heard a lot of things, buddy. Right. And then of course they're like, oh, okay, here we go. Right.
Go but Google me.
How do you even describe it? You know?
Yeah.
That's interesting. You know what is also interesting about you too, is that, you know, you're somebody that came from an urban, well, I guess originally from Toronto, but you decided to live in nature. Like, you don't even have cell reception at your place. You live around here, but you're like only satellite internet communication. What was that like? Why did you make that decision to go and live in the bush, basically, in a rural area? Is that just because of your love of nature, or what kind of made you? And that was before it was cool too. That was like before the pandemic and everyone started moving, right? Yeah. Is there anything that drew you to that sort of lifestyle?
Yeah. I mean, alignment, right? It's that, I think that's a big word for me right now. Integrity, alignment, you know, and I have a lot of thoughts on that, and I can be really honest about where I'm not there yet. Mm-hmm. But this is one of those things where it's like, I feel so much more myself when I'm able to walk outside and I hear the birds singing and I hear the trees rustling and I don't hear traffic and I don't hear, you know, a bunch of people. And I don't feel, most importantly, all these energies happening, because I'm a very sensitive person and I can feel like the wire. When I go to Toronto, I can feel the wires. I can feel like all the buzzing.
A little bit of a claustrophobia feeling.
Some weird, like I feel it the minute I start coming into any city. And being here, it's like everything kind of goes to neutral. It's like I can actually like breathe. I can center myself. I can be in a clear mind. So it has a lot to do with that. And of course, why? Because I believe that we should be living more in tune with nature. I think that we need to shift our values. I wanted to learn how to live more off the land. I'm not like you yet, but you know, I want to learn how to fish. I want to know how to do all these things. I want to know how to fix my own toilet. I want to know how to like do things, you know? And I want to be sufficient. You know, who knows when the apocalypse is coming.
we're going to be a little more set up than the next people.
We'll be more set up for that, you know, like all of these things, like we joke.
Yeah, well, like, the world's a little more fragile society than we all think it is, I think.
Totally.
You know, I remember I was in New York City when Hurricane Katrina or whatever hit, and it was like a freaking gong show, you know, huge lineups at the gas stations. Nobody even knew whether the gas station had gas, fights breaking out, like, right? And then of course we saw what happened with the COVID pandemic, and it definitely felt good to live here, even just for the fact that you're a lot less likely to catch it.
You know, oh, totally. All of those things. I mean, yeah, actually being here during the pandemic was a huge eye opener. Because if the world is ever like that again, or, you know, like when we finally hit the end of the oil rush, you know, what's that going to look like? Anyway, there's a lot of reasons why I moved out here, but I just feel much more myself. I feel, I'm using less waste. I have to plan out my meals. I put more love into my food because I have to cook it. There's no like Uber Eats or like nothing to deliver food to me.
Yeah. And the only restaurant that's probably, it closes at like 7, or it's not even open in the winter most of the time, right?
Right. You never know when something's going to be open or closed up here.
Like, I remember when we were shooting our Nat Geo show, Home in the Wild, one of the producers was like, all right, that's a wrap. Let's all go to a square dancing bar. I'm like, there's not even like a bar. Let alone a square dancing specific bar. Also, why do you think this is a square dancing area? It's because we're in the country. People are just square dancing everywhere. You know, it turned out that there actually was some square dancing thing going on in the town hall in Dunchurch.
But, wow.
Yeah. But
they knew more about it than you did.
Pretty much. Well, there you go.
I guess there is.
Exactly.
That's like that here. But it's also like the community. I think one of the biggest things about living out here is the community. Like, in so-called Toronto, I don't have neighbors I can rely on. I don't have people I can call when it's like, you know, things hit the fan. It's like, but here, I can call on a number of people, and like, it's like family. It's like having family out here. I don't know. It's a different way of being. I mean, obviously there are challenges, especially being a woman of color, but there's a different vibe. With a bunch of
conservative rednecks all over the place.
It's a different vibe. You got to find your people. It's a different vibe.
Yeah, like me? Just kidding. No,
yeah. I'm lucky to have you guys as friends.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that takes some a level of bravery too. Again, we talked about that again. So that's the other explorer's gene thing in you and good for you. I noticed that too, coming from originally, like I always had the outlet of having this water access camp or cottage and stuff like that. But I noticed when I was living in Toronto, it's subconscious. You drive past that last big box store and then there's some fields and some forest. All of a sudden you're just like, you know, and you didn't realize that you're just like, the walls are caving in on you, and because it's just, that's just how you live. And it's not natural. And I think this morning, actually, when I was doing my research on you, which I would need a year to have done it all at least. Cause you're like do so many cool things. But, I remember, there was a study that I think somebody that was interviewing you brought up, and they were talking about how people in communities, so there's a study in communities, they put people together in sort of like, a small space, we'll call it like a townhouse complex or a condo or something, and they put trees around. And all the people were far less depressed, far more, less mental illnesses, use the term, it helped me figure out and work through life's problems. And the other group was, you know, the opposite, that lived in an area that there wasn't trees around. And, you know, I heard that this morning. I'm like, you know what? That literally just happened to me the other day, right? Like, I have all these things going on, you know, the trying to plan for the podcast and all my adventures and family stuff. And sometimes, you know, especially you probably can, I'm not the most organized dude ever, right? I'm working on it, but sometimes I'm like, oh, there's all these little facts, and have I written them down? And it just feels like just buildings just falling on me one after the other, like, you know what I mean? When I get through it, I'm like, oh, okay, I guess I'm done. Like, it wasn't so bad. But living here where I live, like, walking outside just to tend the fire, and we're making maple syrup right now, which, you know, you're probably going to get some of that.
Am I going to get some?
For sure. Great. Yeah, the least I could do. You know, and just being out there and looking, I'm all of a sudden like, it just like goes away. And I'm worried that if I lived in the city, would I really be able to have that sort of release that living in a place that's closer to nature gives? I don't think so. I think it's as much as it's a challenge that things aren't as convenient, in a way that's kind of better because it forces you. I don't miss going to restaurants. You know how much money I blew on going to restaurants when I lived like in the GTA or whatever, you know? And so I love cooking and catching fish right down at the river and cooking it up. And
those are the best days when you just go and like, yeah, you must have a great time with all the things you're able to harvest.
She's looking at the skulls on the wall. Yeah. Yeah. The, we do a little bit of deer hunting right in the area, not far from my house, and have been like successful. And it does give you, you know, because I, you know, like some people, I think somebody that hunts isn't also a nature lover and a conservationist. Well, I am. A lot of indigenous people are as well too. But
When you actually eat the meat and you. Oh,
and just the connection it gives you kind of to the land that you live on, to be part of that. It's a pretty amazing feeling, you know what I mean? Even though it's not all happy, you know, because you had to off a beautiful animal, but it's an amazing feeling.
Well, it can be like a really sacred moment. I mean, I haven't been out hunting with you yet, but when you witness like it being done in a good way, it's like this being is giving itself to you, and especially when you live in a place like this where there's winter. You know, a lot of people rely on meat and dried meat, and, you know, and some people do still like traditionally hunt and, you know, rely on that literally to feed their families. So like, yeah, I think that's a really important skill. I'd love to have that skill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not the best at it. I mean, there's so many different kind of areas of the outdoors and like, you know, to learn, and they all kind of fascinate me, but how, you know, it's hard to be an expert whitewater canoeist and go on these
expeditions.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you're getting better at it though.
I'm getting better at, yeah. And then also the learn how to film. So my whole thing at first was right. And my whole thing at first was learning how to do all these things, and then it became kind of learning how to film all of them as well.
Yeah. I'm not one of those people who like care so much about being really good at one thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm of that mind. Like, I want to know lots of things, you know, and I don't mind if I'm not great at, you know, some of them. That's fine.
What's the most interesting? I like that because you know what? A lot of people don't start something because they think they have to be like amazing at it. Yeah, too.
I feel like men might have more pressure in that department. Probably. I don't really know.
I'm toxically masculine, I've been told. I don't think so, but my wife's kind of like,
awareness, sounds a little awareness toxic-y. Is the first step. First step. I don't know. I can't speak to that.
Okay, good. You've been a lot of interesting places. Is there anywhere that stands out as, I want to say, the most visually beautiful, or the most, where you had the most enriching cultural experience? I know that's probably hard to answer because you've had so many, but if you had to pick something, we won't take it as for sure the best one.
Yeah, I know. I hear you. I think each place has obviously led me on my journey. And so each has its own significance, especially in those moments. I think what I can say is right now, the land that's calling me the most is so-called Colombia. Mm-hmm. There's something about that land. It's like when we start hovering above the land in the airplane, like I can feel the heartbeat of the land, of the jungle, of they've got some of the most beautiful protected water systems, Los Páramos. Like so much fresh water, so much jungle, so much life, like, you know, and then there's the ocean and the coastal regions and like so many types of people and so many stories. And like, there's so much there that's really calling me. And when I go there, for me, a place is more about a feeling. And I'm notoriously somebody who's constantly looking for home. Like, I don't know if I found it here, to be honest. So I'm still looking. And so I feel like everywhere I go, it's like with that intention of like, is this home? Like, you know,
you might, so you might move. So my cousin, lived in Colombia probably for 15 years or more.
Yeah. Really?
When? Yeah, fit maybe 18 years. Yeah, she's a redhead, you know, but fluent Spanish. Yeah, she lives.
So would have seen Colombia going through some really interesting times.
Yeah, well, she moved away because of like social unrest that's going on there. But yeah, she went down, backpacked around there, and kind of ended up settling. And yeah, her kid is Colombian. Her husband, you know, is a Colombian guy, and. So they're kind of adjusting to life in Toronto, essentially. Wild. Now.
Yeah. No, I mean, I can understand that. Honestly, it's got really, like, really tough. I don't like to put things in the past when there's still ongoing, like, issues. There's so much eco-warrior, like, murders of eco-warriors, of indigenous leaders. Like,
because of the people trying to protect logging of the Amazon rainforest. Protectors.
Yeah, not just the logging of the Amazon rainforest. Anyone who's trying to reclaim their land, or anyone who's trying to create movements that have any inkling of, you know, stopping hydroelectric dam projects, for example. Like, there's a lot of...
So big industry is just offing the people that are standing in the way of these things there.
Big, yeah, big time. Yeah. So it's a very dangerous place to operate in that sense. But for me, it's like, yeah, I don't choose things because of comfort.
right.
And that, I think that certain places in the U.S. are more dangerous than certain.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, it's like all very relative.
Right. Yeah. You could find a good, you know, that's something I can relate to too, is that I do go to some, you know, northern communities and, you know, that might have problems in there more per capita than some other places in the South. But I always have an amazing experience, and it's because I'm seeking out, or I'm connecting with the people that are just further building my awe of their culture, or of their lifestyle, or just of, you know, their connection to the land, what they know about the animals. And it just seems like I typically end up making friends with the people that are doing that kind of stuff, whether it's more traditional or, you know, whatever it might be. You know, I guess we do kind of get what we look for.
Exactly. We find, you know, what we seek.
Totally. Yeah. Not to downplay any situations. I'm sure I could move to a really, you know, bad area and get myself in trouble. You know, I'm not saying you can't do that.
An area where you're, not like, with your people, maybe. I hear what you're saying, because the same area could also feel very protected to somebody else, right? It's very, it's all very relative. It's all very, but yeah, I think it's interesting. And then when we talked about the camera earlier, I wanted to mention that I find it also to be like a healing mechanism. I think a lot of the time, it's not really even about so much as telling other people's stories. It's about telling people stories who want to be heard. Because that's a very important distinction, right? Instead of extracting and like trying to like get someone's story, it's like, how can I be a vessel for healing within this, you know? And then when it comes to travel and the camera, I think both of those things are they show you who you are. Like when I'm in the jungle, a lot of the time, like we like to tell, I teach workshops and things like that in Sumatra and other places. And, you know, we often talk about like, how the land like is something that will reveal who you are, you know, like your relationship to it, how you decide to like enter a situation, right? Or a new territory. Like it shows you who you are. It's like a mirror almost. And yeah, in my experience, I've seen that to be true. Same with the ocean. You know, I think Ismael, one of the first things he did with me to kind of like, I feel like he was testing me. He took me out into the ocean. And the first thing we did was he held my hands and said this prayer. And he was like, the gates are open now. Like, and so we waited there for a few minutes and this mother whale and baby humpback whale came up to us and he's like, you can go in with her. And I'm like, are you sure? Like, you know, I'd been with humpbacks before, mm-hmm. but it was with biologists and other people. And like, there was never a prayer. There was never any like asking permission to go into the ocean. It was like a totally unceremonious event mm-hmm. where it's like, let's chase the whale down quickly because they run away fast. Mm-hmm. In this case, it was like, I got in the water. I actually didn't even get in the water right away. I like waited, got my gear together, went in. The whale was like super playful, really wanted to like hang around with me.
So this is just a wild whale.
Yeah.
Yeah, this yeah. isn't SeaWorld. So no. just a random wild whale. yeah. You're just playing with a wild yeah. whale. That is such a cool experience.
Oh, it was one of the coolest yeah. things I've ever mm-hmm. done. And like I said, I've been out with whales mm-hmm. before, but not like this, mm-hmm. where it's just you, the baby. The mom would come up every few minutes to kind of check on us. Mm-hmm. Like imagine this like giant like being rising wow. up, taking a look at you. All right, you're good. We were there together for so long that I was like putting my camera away, like just like if you mimic what a whale's doing, like they see it as play, and especially with the babies. But the problem with the babies is they don't know how big they are, like compared to me. Like they don't know the power of their tail if they slap me or do something right. or like, you know, smack me with their pectoral fin. But like just that feeling of like we are connecting, we are playing, we mm-hmm. are being together, like that was so incredible. But yeah,
and is that because the guy knows how to communicate with them, or he's like a whale whisperer, so to speak? I feel like I'll I look deeper than that.
It, you know, it's deep. It's like an energetic thing. It's so I'm a Reiki practitioner as well, and you mm-hmm. can think whatever you want about that, but I think
it's proven to work.
Yeah, Reiki, yeah, right, especially with breast cancer patients. Okay, so you know that, that's mm-hmm. great. Mm-hmm. But I always wonder like how people are going to react to that. But like
I like to Reiki the lawn in the fall too. That really helps with things.
Really?
That's my extent to the practice.
That's
yeah
beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
But even animal communicators, like mm-hmm. and I'm jumping around a bit, but like they some of the people who come into animal communication start with tracking. It's this understanding that, like, you know, beings leave a scent or a signature, not just a scent, a signature wherever they go, right? And we can feel that energy. Like I can feel, I'm sure you can too, some of your friends' energy who are living around the world right now, right? So I feel like there's this energetic thing, especially with fish, which I've noticed. Because I go snorkeling or free diving to the same spots all the time, mm-hmm. and you get to know the beings that are there. Like sharks are territorial, so you'll come across the same sharks. You'll come across the same fish, schools of fish, things like that that live in certain coral reefs. And like over time, when you continue to do that and you have a good intention and you like really build your intention, they'll start being okay with your presence. Like they won't divide anymore when you come close, or they'll start circling you instead of like running away from you. It's like very interesting.
Yeah, that is definitely some sort of sixth sense or something that you're giving off. And one of the interesting things about connecting, like you're talking about through tracking, if you ever see a print, let's say you see a wolf print, right, and you put your hand in the wolf print and you kind of feel the contours of it, you feel like you're actually touching the actual animal, and it, you know, you kind of connect with something that's sort of a little beyond language in a way, even though it's just the imprint of that foot. And I challenge anybody to go and do that when they actually see a really good animal print. It's just to kind of feel it, because essentially how that print feels is related to what the animal was thinking. Because if it was like, I better run, you know, the print's going to look different than if it's like, I'm going to go slow and then I'm going to look back over my shoulder to see if anything's following me and then I'm going to walk again. So you can kind of connect with maybe what it's thinking. It feels more than just indirectly, you know what I mean? And I think a lot of people have that sense of when they can tell when somebody's staring at them.
Totally.
Right?
Totally. Or what if you, yeah. And the more, it's like photography. Mm-hmm. Like I can see a good image like in 2 seconds. It might take some people who are new, like a few minutes to decide mm-hmm. blah, 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 how they're going to set their settings. For me, it's like instinctual and instant, mm-hmm. you know, and that's what happens when you hone your instincts in a certain thing. So if anyone wants to learn how to communicate with animals or track animals or have this greater like connection with things, I think it's something we can actually build and hone. We just mm-hmm. aren't being taught that in any of these colonial institutions, you know, like, I don't know why they don't want us to connect.
Yeah. With and there's something that's so much that, that science can really learn from that. Absolutely. When scientists want to be able to go and research whales.
Yeah. This is the kind of stuff like I'm so interested in, and we're seeing more of it. Like one of my mentors, Carl Safina, like he has a revolutionary book called How Animals Think and Feel, like beyond words, how animals think and feel. And like, not many people know, I mean, he's a bestseller, but like not many people know of his work. I'm always disappointed when other biologists haven't heard of him. But yeah, this like there's people who study cultures and songs and like especially with whales, right? Like how they communicate with orcas. We're just starting to like get in there, you know, but like their brains are more gentrified than any other being on the planet. Like they probably have more capacity for empathy and communication than we do.
And more of a larger part of the brain that it relates to family connection. Totally, I mean, the family stay together. The kids never move out, I guess, so to speak. They stay with their mothers forever, right?
I can, yeah.
Yeah. Is there anywhere, you mentioned that you're running workshops. Is that something that you're going to be doing in the future?
Yes.
Because I feel like, you know, I've never taken one of your workshops, unfortunately, but I feel like there's more than just specific photography skill involved.
So much more like photography is like day one, you know, like how to use the manual settings on your camera and like all of that. And then it's like a lot more about storytelling and the photography skills, like all of those little things, like, you know, working with natural light, you know, maximizing what you have. That comes along the way, but it's mostly about storytelling.
And so, okay. So, and that's, how important is storytelling in photography in comparison with the artistic ability to frame up a shot, or comparison with the technical aspect of choosing the right settings, aperture, you know, ISO and that kind of stuff?
It's like the basic blocks are, you know, knowing your tools, you know, like the more I know my tools, the more I can craft something really stunning and beautiful. But if it doesn't serve the story I'm telling, then it could just be a beautiful image and nothing more, right? So I think all those components are important and they all build off of each other, and they support the other elements. To me, I think storytelling skill is number one. Personally, like if I hear an interesting idea for a story, I'm much more interested in how can I help you craft that into something really powerful.
Through photos.
Through, the visual imagery, and like we can work on, you know, fine tune all the other things, but the story idea I think is the most important.
And is that more of like a journalistic type of approach to photography than just say a pure Ansel Adams, you know, art approach to it?
I think what we do, you could be any kind of, it could be a fine art, it could be documentary, it could be photojournalistic. The skills that we try to give everyone, it's almost like, here's a great foundation. Now go and have fun and like make your magical art. Because if you look at some of the projects we've taken on and that we've given grants to, like there's not one way that any of them are communicating. Some of them are photojournalists, some of them are artists who have like work in galleries, like, you know, exhibits, who use multimedia. There's one photographer named Tatiana Lopez. I love her work. And Rasha Al-Jundi, they do photographs, which they then embroider afterwards. And, you know, the embroidery has significance. The color of the thread has significance. So there's all of this, all these layers.
Yeah. One of my followers, nobody's going to be able to understand us on the audio podcast, but that's actually a photo that somebody who watches my YouTube channel created, that piece of wood out of a photo with just different types of wood, placing it into looking like the photo.
I love that. And that's part of the story, right? Yeah. That adds to the story.
Yeah, I think so too. Where can people check out your courses and sign up?
Photographerswithoutborders.org.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Nice. And so you run the courses on Photographers Without Borders, but you also do some of those people that take the courses then go and do sort of your larger not-for-profit trips on top of that?
So our courses are online as well as in person. So like the trips would be the in-person workshops. Okay. So I'm leading one in India in November. We're also leading one in Sumatra to work with the indigenous all-female patrol team there that are protecting the national park and the orangutans and the tigers and the elephants.
Well, that's the only place in the world where all those different species of animals live right in the same jungle, right?
Yeah. Yeah. One island for critically endangered tiger, Sumatran tiger, orangutan, elephant, and rhino. Mm-hmm.
I saw a Sumatran tiger at the Toronto Zoo maybe like 4 years ago. So sad.
So sad. I am not a fan of zoos.
You know, it's just I mean, you know, the argument is, well, you know, they don't have any place left for them to live in the wild anymore. And if we can keep them in a zoo, then we could prevent them from extinction or whatever. I guess there's some weight in that. But yeah, it was just pacing back and forth in just a well-worn path.
Yeah, I know just, that. I know that tiger. Yeah, I visited that tiger.
The Sumatran tiger?
Several times, yeah. I remember they had the cage outside in October, and it was so cold. Mm-hmm. They also had an orangutan there who some kid threw a candy wrapper at, and then it ate it and died.
Really?
Yeah. There's a statue, like, right next to the Sumatran tiger that they have. Yeah.
Maybe I didn't see that. I don't know.
It's funny because it's illegal to keep orangutans in in Indonesia, so it's funny that even in a zoo, actually, like technically. So it's funny when I think about other zoos having orangutans, it's like, yeah. I'm a very anti-zoo person, let's just put it that way. But I also...
Seems to be more the way things are going, right? Like,
well, I mean, it's coming back to that intactness narrative and the power of language, and also extending beyond that, the power of like what we promote and what we narrate, right? Mm-hmm. So like... the zoo narrative of like, you know, the genes are being preserved and there's nowhere else for it to go. Like that narrative serves their funding and their donors, right? It doesn't serve the actual being because really nobody should be exploited or commodified in order to like, and a lot of zoos don't even support like in the intactness of habitats, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that that provides us very false sense of safety, and it also teaches kids who are the main, you know, the main I guess visitors or like the main reason a person would visit, it provides this like education or miseducation where it's like, okay, I have the right as somebody lives in frigid Toronto to go and see a lion in the middle of winter, like, you know, it's like what kind of, you know, mentality does that. And then when you think about the origins of zoos too, like as being these like
come and look at the wild beasts and poke them with sticks,
right?
You know, and they're in a cage, and
and they used to have indigenous people next to
They did in the World's Animals, Fair or whatever,
right? Exactly.
Some South Americans were literally like in a zoo, you know what I mean? Some indigenous South Americans in the World's Fair, I forget what year. So this really happened before.
So this is like about alignment for me. It's like, okay, what aligns for me? Like, it doesn't align.
It doesn't align as a protector. Yeah. I think, you know, sometimes two things can kind of be true. Like, I do think there is
you can hold
a point with that narrative. So, yeah. So I don't 100% have an answer of what the right thing to do, but
I don't think
I still
right
look
thing.
At that Sumatran tiger. And I'm like, this is effed. You know what I mean? I'm like, this is just not right. Like, that's what my instinct told me, you know.
That instinct is so important to listen to,
right? Yeah I mean, I wasn't gonna go free the thing, you know.
That's my job. I'd love nothing more than that tiger roaming around Toronto.
It's like, on the glass floor in the CN Tower, like seeing the sights.
If I could find a way to bring that back to Sumatra, I would, honestly. Yeah if there were like more of me, or maybe we can get Phil Demers onto it. I don't know if you know him, but he's super cool.
What about the guy from The Price is Right? He helped the elephants, didn't he?
Really?
Yeah, he got the elephants moved out of the Toronto Zoo to somewhere else.
I did not know that. That's awesome.
Yeah, what's his name? Who cares?
Some guy.
Yeah, that's awesome. So, you know, on all your travels, is there anything, what's the most interesting thing that you've eaten?
Oh my gosh, you don't want to know.
I do. I really
do. Interesting things.
I'm not going to try to one-up you, but I have a couple stories too.
Okay. Oh, I want to hear your stories. There's a few. Okay. I had a beaver tail, like an actual beaver's tail, up in, where was it? Fort Albany in Moose Cree territory. That was actually quite delicious. Very greasy, thick. And then when we were in Cambodia, honestly, like Cambodia's got a very, again, like interesting history, lots of dark times, where people, you know, basically ate everything that they could. So that tradition has stayed. And so there's lots of things that you can eat there. Are we like anything you want.
Wendigo territory here?
Wendigo territory.
I heard anything like cannibalism is kind of what popped in
there. Actually, you know, one of my best friends, she's Batak, and she comes from a community that's known as being cannibals, but like it's again colonial narratives gone haywire.
Gone haywire, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know. Yeah. I mean, I think didn't Captain Cook also get eaten by the Hawaiians?
I think he was definitely killed by the Hawaiians.
Yeah, they definitely, on Valentine's Day.
It was Papua New Guinea where they had a ritual traditional where they weren't like killing people and eating them every day. It was like when somebody died, they would consume them.
Yeah, there's different ways of what in which that would come about. Yeah. And I find it all very interesting again. Like, but anyway, what was the ritual?
Sorry, a bit of a tangent. Went into the cannibalism. Well, it was, I was talking with somebody I had on the show the other day who wrote the book Moon of the Crusted Snow. And there was a bit of a cannibalism narrative in there that tied into the Wendigo.
Oh, interesting.
And I know that you've done some stories on that. So,
yeah. But it wouldn't relate to like the weirdest things I've eaten, though. So
good. Not that I'm gonna hold any. But anyways, yeah. What else? We'll get back on track.
I mean, it's like it's funny because it's like weird to who, I guess. Mm-hmm. I tried to eat. They have something there. I can't remember what it's called, but it's like a raw duck fetus.
Mm-hmm. A raw duck fetus.
Something like that. How I honestly. Was it? Not my favorite. Mm-hmm. And then I don't know if you've heard of durian. No. Have you heard of durian?
No.
Oh, it's like the smelliest, stinkiest fruit. Orangutans love it. Mm-hmm. I do not, but a lot of people in Indonesia, they love it. It's almost like a jackfruit, but like slimier, stickier, and it has a smell. It has a smell. Like if you go to any hotels in Indonesia, they'll say like, no durian.
Oh, allowed. Just don't.
No
even
smoking.
Bring
no this. No that. Yeah. No durian.
Yeah. Wow. And it's just a fruit that grows on trees, but it has a really strong smell to
it. It's pungent. Yeah. Yeah.
I know. I'm kind of the guy that likes everything. Like I don't want to say a lot of people that will, for example, eat traditional Inuit food that aren't from that culture will be like, ew, gross. But
yeah, exactly.
I don't kind of want to like diss other people's food. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
No, and I know. Say, I've actually made my mistakes, you know, and like, I think I did say ew when I ate the duck fetus. And I felt really bad after because someone Cambodian like was like, this is one of our traditional foods. And it was actually a really big aha moment. It was like, I have to look at this differently. And suck it challenged it my, not only suck it up, but it's like it challenged my narratives. And it also, I reflected back on like, the situation, the genocide that they were going through, like they ate whatever they could. And I don't know if that's where that comes from, but like, I need to respect, you know,
suck it up is my term for challenge my narrative.
Well, you could suck it up because you can literally suck it out of the egg.
Good point. Yeah, no, I've eaten. The thing with me though, when it comes to eating these interesting types of food, I love it. Like, right. So I don't get grossed out easily, which is probably why I won alone.
Yeah.
Because I definitely had to survive on the grossest things every day.
What did you eat anyway?
Oh man. Limpets, chitons, rainforest slugs. I boiled these like mushrooms. This is one of the best things I had. I boiled these like mushrooms. I'd find wild mushrooms as I was walking and kind of keep them in this little kind of gator that I had that I made into a bag, and I'd stuff them all in there as I went. And then I'd just boil them and I'd eat some that night. And then I didn't have anywhere to keep them, so I'd store them in my hat. And the next day I'd just wake up and eat these like boiled, like overboiled, unseasoned mushrooms. And that's how I'd start my day. I called it the breakfast of champignons.
Champignons. Right? The breakfast is champignons.
You speak French, right? So yeah. So that was like one of the better things. You know, also lily pad tubers, which you really have to boil and reboil and redump the water, reboil. And so I did that, but not enough times, and was this close to barfing from it. You know, I found watercress and stuff like that. And we did get fish, but not enough to always sustain. So I was just force feeding myself. And I remember trying all the different foods that were relatively accessible out there and just being like, oh, this is terrible. And then like the next one, also terrible, you know, and it just came in. It's just like, I'm not going to be eating anything
escargot,
yummy.
Anybody?
at all. Yeah, yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Nothing was, you know, anyways, but
especially like you're a big guy, like feeding, making sure that you're like sustained to do all the physical activity you have to do. Like, wow.
Yeah. 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 One of the things that we were noticing too is just that I was that there's no fat in a lot of the stuff. So eating these things called limpets, which are essentially just like a half shelled snail that stick to these rocks and you have to like pry them off the rock.
Those are. I was shocked that you were, because at some points that was all you could find, right?
Right. And we realized that they come out at night and they start moving around. And when they're on the move, you can grab them. You don't have to pry them off. And there's like tons of them.
You just
pull. Yes, we learned the way of the limpet. And one night I picked like 1,000 of these things and you just eat them. But then they have protein in them, but you get something called rabbit starvation, which is, protein poisoning, I think is the technical word, means you have such high protein levels, but your body can't digest it because there's no fat in it. So you could eat an endless amount of limpets and you would still eventually starve to death because your body can't process it without having enough fat.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
You learned so many things watching alone.
Yeah. So yeah. Well, there's a new one. Like
I always think about like different versions of it that I'd want to be on.
Would you like ever do Friends something like version. That?
No. If there was Friends. Yeah. Like if there was like you could be
Ross
with four people.
And Phoebe and stuff like that.
If I could have 3 other people with me, great.
It would be a little bit more nice to have some other people. And then maybe you could that way have like a little bit of split up a little bit of a tribe and split up different things to do. Maybe you'd have more of a.
Is it becoming more like Survivor then?
Maybe, but I think it would still be real. You all got to film it yourself.
I'd be so down to do something like that, even in my backyard, just to see if I could do it. I think it's so cool that you've done that and that you won. And,
I mean, you got to start somewhere in your backyard and then you just go inside if it rains, right? Like, nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. Oh, I've done things like that, like soloed outside by myself a few times, you know? Like, I love camping. All those things. I think that would be the adventure of a lifetime. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Alone, so cool. Alone was hard though. It was like super hard. Like I wasn't probably not as much danger at some places because I did have that kind of support crew that could extract me. But as far as misery and by the time you're really into it and you're losing weight and every day is a struggle.
Cold and the rain.
Just sucks into you. That part was hard. But it was like, you know, it was very clear, like just like fasting, which a lot of cultures do, a lot of indigenous North Americans do a vision quest and they see things really clearly. There's all kinds of things that I saw a lot to do with food way more clearly through that experience. You know what I mean?
I'm very curious. Yeah.
And I also
that.
Like now when I go camping, I'm just like eating the brains of the fish I catch. And some
of
my friends
every
are like,
piece
what are you?
Of
like,
it.
Oh man,
they're
delicious. You don't eat the brains of the trout? Like it's so buttery. So I eventually started liking that stuff that most people would be like gross. Right. So, you know, I think that if any kind of culture's food, if you're exposed to it enough, it's going to start tasting good to you.
Oh, totally. I'm like, I love things that have like, you know, relatively weird textures or tastes. Like I'm not one of those people who, you know, was picky about their chicken nuggets and spaghetti as a kid. Like I wanted to try all the random things on the menu. Like nice. I love that. Yeah,
I think maybe that's just a born that way thing too. Or do you think
explorer gene?
I think maybe
taste bud exploration.
Maybe not the explorer gene, but I think that like it's you maybe taste buds.
Yeah I'm maybe very intrigued.
Maybe
I love all kinds of food. Nothing scares me. Like I'll try it. I'll try anything.
I think it's interesting. Have you had a similar experience? Like one of the things that you probably see in areas where they don't have the privilege and the I don't know, all the kind of things that we have in our modern society here, access to in Canada, do you see it also as something that is interesting? You know what I mean? I've been to some remote Inuit communities where people are sort of, you know, I've seen people living in, one guy had just like a house made of boxes from shipping crates. You know what I mean? And he lived on the land and he had a dog sled team with like a caribou in front of each dog. That's how he like fed the dogs. And, you know, this was by choice. He wanted to go do this. And, you know, and a lot of people would look at that and be like, oh, the poor, you know, poor guy, we need to get him. We need to do this differently, or we need to get more aid or more job opportunities and everything, which I think is true too. But at the same time, I could see that, but I also think that there's something interesting about experiencing people that are living a different lifestyle without as much things as we have. And are still, you know, happy, you know, and more giving than we are in our society.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, I really have moved away from that mentality of like comparing, because it's so relative. Like, what do I have compared to that person? What do they need? You know, it's not up to me to decide what someone else needs or lacks or wants or whatever. Like, I mean, I have a completely different lifestyle and way of seeing than most people. And I think everyone's very unique. Mm-hmm. And of course, I've seen so many situations, I mean, countless situations where there's things that money can't buy, you know, that I wish I had that you get from being in a community. You know, there's the growing up on my land, like, you know, not growing up on my territory, being mixed, which makes you confused as to like, okay, like if I want to reconnect to a territory, where do I even start, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I see a lot of different ways of seeing that. I admire people who are totally going on their own path, mm-hmm. who want to do things a different way, want to, is that the alarm for 1:30?
Yeah.
Should we finish this question?
Then I'm going to leave it. We'll leave it. We can edit this part out. And then we'll leave it. This has been a great chat, by the way.
yeah.
And yeah, finish this. I don't know. You know, just about whatever, however you want to phrase it. Then I want to just a little bit for people that might want to get into photography, that might want to learn about it. Just a few first steps they might want to try, and then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah. Sounds good. Sounds okay. Great. Yeah, thank you.
No problem.
Yeah, it has been great. Yeah, so I think the way that I see things, and, you know, I have an international development background intersecting with the conservation and the psychology stuff that I've done. But, like, in that work, we were taught to see through the colonizing white savior lens, like, let's go to this community and see what they need. Like, how do we, you know, bring up their GDP to whatever, whatever. And it's like, I think
let's build a Walmart over here.
Oh my gosh, they would really benefit from this port, which brings me to Colombia. So I just came from a workshop in the Gulf of Tribuga. It's recently been named a UNESCO Biosphere Reserve. It's one of the most biodiverse places on the planet. Most people haven't heard of it. And the people that live there are a combination of Embera native people and like freed people who freed themselves from slavery by going through the jungles and claiming this land for themselves, this coastal region.
Interesting.
And have created their own system of governance, their own way of being, and they love it the way it is. And it's basic, but it's working. It's they've successfully fought off a port that the government, of course, in that mentality of like, oh, these poor people, like, they need a port so that they can bring in commercial goods and that we can, you know, have this thing of commerce over here. And the community fought against that hard. They also killed people who were standing up against that port.
Wow.
But the community ended up winning and they don't have a port there. And that's a great example. Actually, there's a beautiful documentary coming out about that, that my friend, Mariana Rivera Uribe participated in making. And, it just shows you like there's lots of communities that are examples of like, we don't want to do your colonial Western ways, you know, like we don't want that. Like, thank you, but no thanks. Like, I don't need a freaking concrete plaza with a Walmart, you know, and I'm with them. I'm like, please don't be like this. Like, I fully agree that every community should have its own way of determining its own future, its own sovereignty,
which is what we get back to the kind of grassroots, instead of saying, okay, this is what we should give them, this is what will help them. We can talk to the people specifically and start it with their voices and ideas, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's what I think. Let's ask other people what they want. Like, what do you need?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's, you guys need a Walmart.
And what do I need? Like, what am I looking for? It's not just me going to a community and being like, oh, like, you know, how sweet, like, what you're doing. It's not this, like, patronizing, infantilizing relationship. It's a reciprocal relationship. I've never left a situation or a community where I haven't received so much in return, you know? So it's not just, like, a top-down, like, aid complex, right? Or like a, you know, support or helping complex. It's a collaboration mechanism where we're actually, we're learning from so many of these communities and we're able to tell their story or do something. I don't even know. Maybe we're taking more than we're giving in many circumstances. I can't speak for you, but I'll speak for myself. Mm-hmm. But I think that's the key for me is like, how do I build more reciprocity in that engagement in that process?
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Well, that's great. And if there's anything that you can share, like let's say somebody that's listening to this wants to get into photography and wants to take the first steps using the camera to bring them to some of the amazing places you've been and meet the people that you've met, what would you say to them? What might be the first steps to try to follow that path?
I love that. I think first and foremost, like I said, the story is the most important, whether it's, you know, like it's a feeling inside of you that you want to express or there's something that you're really like, that's really meaningful to me and I really want to like share more, like start there. And then the tools follow. Like many people have cameras with phones on them. That's a good place to start if you don't have the financial means. If you do, like I recommend getting a basic DSLR or a mirrorless camera, you know, I use Sony personally. And then it's just experiment, use YouTube if you want to learn the mechanisms of the camera. And then I think the biggest thing for me is like, I don't encourage anyone to really do like formal schooling when it comes to art. I really encourage folks to instead find mentors, workshops where you can take in different elements from different people in a less committed way. Because then you're learning from people who are actually like living artists who are working and not people that are like teaching it. I say that in the most loving way possible. But that's a big thing I would say is really important is to like seek out mentorship and don't put anyone on a pedestal while you're doing that.
Interesting. When I was on a loan before launch, they gave us this crash course in how to film, how to cover a scene, how to follow a story. And I was thinking, this is amazing, but it's because it's all led by producers and professional film guys.
Yeah. Shooters. Like film school usually is that. I think for film, I would, I kind of sometimes wish I went to film school, to be honest. But for photography, I think, man, like you'll be so much more free to develop your craft if you stay away, I think, from those spaces in a sense. I've actually met a lot of people who went to photography school, quit, and then stopped being a photographer.
So it worked in reverse.
Yeah, it can be traumatizing to be graded on your art.
Yeah, good point. We talked about that a little.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Danny, thank you so much for being on the show. I had a great chat and maybe we can do it again sometime.
Yeah, it was quite stimulating for this Thursday morning. Thank you so much. I really appreciated it.
You're very welcome.